When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, a writer and researcher at MLB.com, joined by Matt Myers, MLB.com national content editor. Today is Thursday, November 9th. The offseason is in full swing. And of course, all anybody wants to talk about is small ball and bunting, which we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about all the comments that came out of Yankees Media Day and how everybody seems to want to be the Diamondbacks now for some reason. We're going to talk about what's going to be ahead in this hot stove. I feel like we're going to see a lot of trades. We'll talk about trades. We'll talk about managers, first baseman. And third, we're going to talk about where every team begins the offseason. It's not just the rosters they had to end the year. Obviously, teams have lost players to free agency. So we're going to look into where everybody has to go over this winter's hot stove. Matt, how many bunts do you expect the Yankees to put down next year? Here's the brief backstory for those who didn't hear. The Yankees had a media day the other day. They were the final team to do like their end of season media availability. And general manager Brian Cashman went kind of off on his defensive analytics, which I think he's mostly right about. And then there were comments that came out that said Aaron Boone wants to prioritize bunting more, and that Aaron Judge wants to prioritize batting average and RBI. And I certainly hope that the 1975 Yankees have a good year next year. Where do you start with this, Matt?
The Yankees had a weird one, right? It was a series of things. It was in the course of a day. I think Hal Steinbrenner and Brian Cashman had availability, and Hal talked about Aaron Boone having a premonition about wanting to bunt more, and then Cashman went on a rant about analytics with some expletives, and then apparently Aaron Judge is now involved in making decisions. So, and it's just funny, mostly because the Yankees have been like so buttoned up for so long, to see like cracks in the armor, so to speak. I think is just as an outsider, just sort of surprising to see this kind of talk, and it's a bit strange too, right? Where like if you had gone into the season and been like, okay, Carlos Rodon barely going to pitch, and Aaron Judge is going to miss a bunch of time, how many games the Yankees going to think the Yankees are going to win? You might have said like 80-85 games,
and Rizzo and Nestor Cortez. Like, it wasn't just those two guys, right? Like, injuries, and you know, partially you can point to Brian Cashman and say, well, you put together the roster full of guys who tend to get injured. That's totally fair. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right about that, and I want to offer like a very mild, lukewarm defense of Aaron Boone here. So correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think Aaron Boone is actually there. Didn't get quoted. This is all like secondhand statements of like what he's feeling. So Hal Steinbrenner said this, and I quote, "I think Aaron Boone thinks we're not teaching young players to bunt enough. A few years ago in player development, we cut back on bunting skills. So Aaron Boone feels it's becoming a bigger part of the game. So we're going to start right up again." And while I disagree on it becoming a bigger part of the game, I think it's fair that like if that's a tool you want in your toolkit, that you want the players to know how to do it. Like, there are so many times where people be like, why didn't that guy bunt? It was a perfect opportunity for a bunt. And the answer that you don't hear is he hasn't bunted in like 8 years. He has no idea how to bunt. Bunting isn't easy, no matter how many times people say it is. So it's like, if you want, you know, not Judge, not Stan, but I don't know, Oswald Peraza to come up knowing how to lay one down, I can respect that. I think that's fair.
And I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, it's also hard to know if what Steinbrenner's saying is like an actual reflection. And it's like, it's a little bit of a game of telephone, right? I mean, I do think, you know, listeners of this podcast are well aware of probably where we stand on this, of just like, generally speaking, the impacts of bunts are wildly overstated and generally not a good strategic move, at least sacrifice bunts. I do love me a good drag bunt for a hit, but those are surprise moves, or those are certain players in certain moments that can execute them. You don't want Aaron Judge bunting for a hit, especially now that the shift is, there was a time when the shift was allowed, where there were times with a slugger at the plate, if it was open, that wasn't a bad play. But there's no more shift anymore, so, or at least not such that the half the field is wide open. So I don't really know. It's hard to imagine the Yankees are going to go into next year and suddenly starting to bunt a lot more because, like, no matter what people say, and it seems like there's a lot of conversation about this, home runs, there's pretty strong evidence that home runs are what win games.
Yeah, there's been a lot of – this offseason's been kind of bizarre. It's only like a week into the offseason, so I say like a whole offseason. You're already hearing teams like really starting to talk about this. So new White Sox hitting coach Marcus Thames, who was the Yankees hitting coach from 2017 to 21, and then Marlins and Angels last 2 years. So he got hired by the White Sox, and he said, and I quote, "I think the game has come to a point where situational hitting has become a lost art until the postseason. And then you see teams trying to bunt and hit and run and stuff like that during the postseason. And I think what's happening here is people watched Arizona get to the World Series when they were like an undergunned team for the most part. And they're, in my opinion, taking the wrong lessons from what Arizona did, right? Like, you look at Arizona as a team. They won 84 games. Fine. They were the sixth playoff seed. They had the 15th most runs scored. You know, they didn't bunt their way to the playoffs. And in the postseason, I'm trying really hard not to take away from a team that just went to the World Series, right? But the Dodgers had no starting pitchers and the Brewers didn't have any starting pitchers and they went 9-7 in October. That's the thing. They didn't blow their way through and like dominate every. They went 9-7 and I get it. They went to the World Series. The Dodgers didn't, the Braves didn't, I didn't. Fine. But like to look at the Diamondbacks and say, yeah, they were successful because they bunted. I don't know if you remember this, Matt. I remember number three hitter Gabriel Moreno dropping down a bunt in the World Series and it not working out. These are the wrong lessons to be learned here.
Not only that, they out-homered the Brewers and won the series. They out-homered the Dodgers 9-1 and won the series.
9-1.
They were out-homered by the Phillies in the LC, sure. In the LCS. They were out-homered and they still won the series. That said, in the entirety of the playoffs, that was the only series this year. That was the only single one where the team that hit fewer home runs won the series. Right. And then the Rangers obviously hit a lot more homers than the I think it was 11-5 in the World Series than the D-backs. So, I mean, it's funny because like it's weird for me to hear hitting coaches say these things, because I think as a fan, when I hear fans say like, oh, I wish there were fewer home runs, I wish there was more hit and run, I wish there was more action on the base pass, from like an aesthetic view, from an aesthetic standpoint, that makes perfect sense. I do think it'd be nice if there was more variety in the types of offenses that succeeded, and that when we watch baseball games, you could have debates over like what's a better way to win. But like right now, with the way the game is, with pitchers so good missing so many bats, it's really hard to put together rallies of like multiple singles. You really have to win with short sequence offense. So aesthetically, I get it, but for a hitting coach, it's like, no, actually, hitting coach, you should be teaching your guys to hit dingers.
One of the like top rules of life, whether it's in sports or careers or anything, is if you have an enemy, a competitor, an opponent, like whatever, don't do things where they will be likely very happy about it, right? Because if I'm some of these other teams, if I'm the Rays, I'm the Orioles, great example, and I hear the Yankees might play more small ball next year, I'm like, yes, I'm doing cartwheels around Camden Yards. I will leave with this, though. I'll give Aaron Judge the benefit of that on one thing. While I strongly disagree that any team should be prioritizing batting average and RBI, it is fair to note that the Yankees had the 29th best or second worst batting average ahead of only Oakland. And even I cannot justify that, right? That has to improve. You do not win games with the second worst batting average in baseball. I think that's fair enough. It's going to be a real weird and interesting offseason here in New York for both teams. I can't wait. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back on the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We are back on the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Mike Petrillo and Matt Myers. We got a couple of off-season topics we want to get to. And the first one that really stands out to me is like, what kind of hot stove are we going to see? It's not a great free agent market. Obviously, Shohei Ohtani will take up all the oxygen in the room for sure. The market for hitters is super weak. I think there's a lot of questions about Cody Bellinger and Matt Chapman. The market for starting pitchers is better. But I think what's going to happen here, between the weakish market, between the number of teams who are going to have some amount of financial questions because of the RSN upheaval that's going on, you're going to see trades. Like, I think you're going to see a lot of trades. And I think if you're a team that has a good starting pitcher to trade and you don't necessarily think you're going to contend, like right now, I made a list, right? Contending teams that need multiple starting pitchers include the Dodgers, Orioles, Padres, Red Sox, Mets, Cardinals, Reds, Giants, Diamondbacks, and then teams like the Yankees, Cubs, Phillies need at least one, and I certainly didn't name everybody. So it's like, I think trades are going to be the story of the offseason. Yes, Juan Soto, for sure, but like Dylan Cease, Glasnow, Shane Bieber, Corbin Burns, I think there's a lot of interesting fits there, not only with the teams I just mentioned, but like, you know, you look at the Reds and Orioles, like these younger win now or soonish teams who have more young infielders than they know what to do with. You cannot staff all these guys, move them to trade to find solve a situation elsewhere. I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
I have long thought that the you're going to be the team that kind of dictated this offseason because they generally have a history of trading guys before they hit free agency. And this year they happen to have three key players entering their last year of club control of last year of arbitration before they go to free agency. Corbin Burns, Brandon Woodruff, and Willy Adames. And Burns is like, and then there's not to mention the whole manager upheaval thing, which we'll talk more about a little bit, but like, in the trade market, I think Woodruff's hurt. He's going to miss most of, if not all, of next year. And they have to decide whether or not they want to offer him, tender him a contract. I could see them trading him to another team who's like, I want to tender him a contract, or maybe work out a multi-year deal with like options and opt-out incentives. That'll be an interesting story to monitor in the next week. But Corbin Burns, like for the reasons you mentioned, I think the Brewers are kind of going to blow things up a little bit because they have a lot of good young position player talent coming up to the system. But like, they're going to need to reset, if not this year, then next year, because they're not going to re-sign Corbin Burns. I think it's fair to say they're not going to re-sign him. Almost certainly not going to re-sign Willy Adames. At this point, Woodruff, you don't know what you have. So Burns, I mean, it would be shocking to me if he's not in a different uniform on opening day. And he's one of the best pitchers. He pitched well in the second half of the season. One of the best pitchers in baseball. Like, that's how you rebuild a farm system right there, trading a guy like that. So to me, that's like first and foremost, maybe more so than Juan Soto, just because like I'm certain he's going to get, I'll never say, you know, 100%, but like I'm way more certain he's going to be traded than Juan Soto.
I would agree with that. And then if you do trade Corbin Burns, are you trading Devin Williams, right? Devin Williams has one extra year, so he's not a free agent until after 2025. One of the best relievers in baseball. It's sort of hard to count on relievers long-term, right? So you almost wonder, like, well, if we don't have Burns and Woodruff, should we trade Devin Williams? I mean, do you think the Orioles don't need Devin Williams? The Mets, the Dodgers? I shouldn't even name teams. Who is the team who doesn't need Devin Williams? They all do. And I'm with you. Like, I don't want to sit here and say, man, I hope the Brewers blow it up and lose 110 games next year, you know, because that's not what I want. They've been a really good story for the last decade, but for the first time in years, they are at a real inflection point, right? Council's gone. David Stearns is gone. Woodruff is injured. This is the way it turns over, I think, is now. And I think you're right. I think it's going to happen this winter.
It will be interesting to see because, like, you know, you mentioned Stearns, like the Mets are a team that's very much like looking to make moves that needs pitching. And you wonder, is this going to be one of those situations where Stearns is like, hey, like I know these guys, I can make a deal. Or maybe it's like, in some ways it makes it more awkward where they feel like they're too worried that they know each other too well, that they like are going to be, because I could see it going either way, right? Where it's like, oh, we have this relationship. We know how to talk to each other. We'll make a deal. Or is it kind of like, I don't want to end up getting fleeced long-term by this guy I used to work with for many years. It almost looked like egg on my face because it looked like I don't know how to evaluate my own talent. But that's like the storyline to watch, because in many ways that's like an obvious they are obvious trade partners in a lot of ways, because the Mets have a lot of really good prospects close to the majors who would theoretically be the type of players that the Brewers would value.
Our friend and colleague Mark Feinstein is working on an all trade rumor team where he basically picked an interesting trade candidate at each position. There's a couple of interesting names on this list. Juan Soto, obviously. There were two guys that he mentioned that I thought were perfect, because I'm like, again, I won't say 100%, 99.98% sure that they're going to get traded. Jonathan India from the Reds and Alex Verdugo from the Red Sox. And neither one of them are like, you know, needle movers, game changers, but they're both like solid young veterans who are still in their 20s. The Reds just have so many infielders. And I know there's a lot of stories like India's the, you know, kind of been the heartbeat of the clubhouse, and that's fine. I'm not dismissing that. They just don't have enough places to play all these guys. They desperately need starting pitching. That is the guy you trade. And then in Boston, I mean, Alex Verdugo didn't have a great year last year. Got benched a couple of times. It really seems like a change of scenery guy. It's funny. You could, I guess, probably not. I was going to say, could you just flip them? Because the Red Sox really, really need a second baseman, like really desperately badly need a second baseman. I guess Verdugo is not really the player that the Reds need. They need pitching. But those are the two guys who stood out for me from that list.
I mean, India is interesting because he's also under club control for three more seasons, whereas Verdugo is a free agent after next year. It would be a fun kind of like a challenge trade if they end up getting flipped for each other. But to your point, I think India, he is the kind of player that probably there's a wide opinion on what he brings. Cause like statistically he's pretty good, not great. You know, some might say average, maybe tick above, like, but there's this, you know, this like last year when it was suggested he got traded, noted Reds fan Kurt Herbstreit went bananas on social media saying, how could you trade this guy? He's the clubhouse leader. It was funny just because of the outrage, but like there's obviously something to it, and the certain clubs will value that more than others. We'll say like, oh, this guy is a very solid player, and we think that he's a winning player and we want him on our team, and maybe see that opportunity where it's like the Reds kind of are in a bind. They kind of don't really have a spot for him, and maybe there's an opportunity to get him. Not like you're going to get him for, I mean, not that his trade value is not such that he would command like a top 50 prospect to begin with. So it's like, hey, we want this guy. We value him more than everyone else. We think that there's like something here that will be good for our clubhouse.
I want to throw out something else to you too. The starting pitching options I mentioned are mostly veterans either entering their walk year or within 2 years, right? Cease, Glasnow, Bieber, Burns. I feel like there's going to be opportunity for a team who has young starting pitching to move and try to get something like really good for a guy you can control for like 3 or 4 years. And the problem is if you have guys like that, you mostly don't want to trade them. There's not that many teams who fit that description, but do the Seattle Mariners fit that description? Like, is Logan Gilbert wearing Dodger blue or, I don't know, Orioles orange or whatever? Like, that just, Jerry DePoto always has something up his sleeve, right? That feels like something he could do to get a bat he desperately needs.
The Orioles are the other team that's like an obvious, you know, they have all these great young position players. They need high-end pitching. They didn't go out and sign a big free agent pitcher last year. And like, you know, I wanted to sign Carlos Rodon based on Carlos Rodon's season. Probably they were wise not to. I mean, he's got a few more years in that deal. Maybe it'll turn out. So like they're the team to watch because they could swing a trade for a Logan Gilbert easily with some of the prospects that they have. And their system almost wouldn't even feel it. They also have one of the lowest payrolls in the game. So they also could go out and be like, you know, we're going to sign Aaron Nola or Blake Snell or Aaron Nola and Blake Snell. So there's a lot of different ways it could go, but I kind of think they're going to go the trade route because I think most likely this is my speculation, but that they're the kind of team that's like, yeah, we could go sign free agents, but we also have this core of players we want to keep around. And if we want to sign Adley Rutschman to an extension and Gunnar Henderson to an extension, those are obviously the first two names that come to mind. Those are going to get expensive pretty quickly. So I'm not sure though. I think they're more likely to kind of value extending their own players as opposed to going out and signing free agents. Although there's the one Orioles name who's not one of their young prospects who Feinstein mentions, and that's Anthony Santander, who is a free agent after this year, who's a pretty good player who I think he wouldn't bring you back a Logan Gilbert straight up, but like he could be a piece that gets you something good. The problem is a rebuilding team doesn't really want Anthony Santander. So maybe more of like a deal of like what we're talking about of like, hey, we're a pretty good team who has this piece. We'll trade you one veteran. You may need a veteran bat. We need a veteran, good veteran, like number three starter or, you know, setup man. And that might be a match there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Our second topic, we had to talk about the managerial merry-go-round. Craig Counsell's a Cub. Didn't see that one coming. That was a really, really entertaining like 25 minutes when Ken Rosenthal reported Craig Counsell has picked a team and that team already has a manager. And everybody did the mental exercises of, wait, I'm sorry, what? Which team is throwing their guy overboard? It turns out it was the Cubs. with David Ross. The Angels have hired Ron Washington. The Guardians have hired Stephen Vogt. The Mets hired Carlos Mendoza. My dad and my uncle keep asking me who that is. Hope you guys are listening. I still don't know, but we're all going to figure it out together. As of the moment we're recording, the Padres, Astros, and Brewers are all searching for a manager. It seems like Joe Espada is probably going to get the Astros job, but the fact that he hasn't might say something about that. Let me ask you about Council, because his statements when he got hired made it clear that he views managers in terms of being like free agents, like players, which I think makes a ton of sense. And, you know, he kind of broke the managerial salary scale, yet at the same time, he got the same similar-ish contract to, as I saw someone say on Twitter, like James McCann. He's not getting paid like he's Shohei, which, like, good for him. You know, he's certainly earned the right. So I never thought we'd spend this much time talking about managerial moves, but the last couple of days have been wild.
It was kind of low-key the way it went down, because usually, like, what usually happens, the industry standard is like when a successful or quote-unquote good manager enters the last year of their contract, they say like, oh, I want an extension, and usually they get it, right? That's kind of what happens, because they're like, oh, I don't want to be a lame duck. I don't want to manage as a lame duck. And I've always thought that was a little overstated, frankly. And I think Craig Council kind of just proved it, because he was like, no, I'm going to go to free agency. And there was speculation, oh, he might sit out a year. No, he did not sit out a year. He went to a division rival, and he actually, he went the free agency route, which is like, we don't really see managers do very often. I honestly can't remember another example of this really happening like this, where a in-demand manager saw his, I'm sure it has happened, but like saw his contract expire and then went and took a job with a new team basically immediately as soon as the season ended. I mean, the question for me is more just like, obviously Council is like, he's a known quantity, and I think the floor is pretty high. It's just like, how good is he? I mean, I think I remember like 538 did an analysis, and this was like 10 years ago, of like managers being like plus or minus two wins.
I think that's right. I think he's very good. I think he's very well respected with the bullpen. I think he's a step up over David Ross. I liked David Ross, but Council is probably more well regarded. Question is, how good are the Cubs going to be? Right? I mean, they didn't make the playoffs last year. I know they had a collapse in September, and at the moment, they don't have Cody Bellinger. They don't have Marcus Stroman. Obviously, they will go out and add players, but I think it's kind of an open question as to, people see that contract and they think, oh well, Cubs are open for business. We're going to get Ohtani, Bellinger, and Aaron Nola. And I don't think it's going to work that way. So they need to improve the roster. If the roster is improved, then he will look like a star. And if not, then he will not look like a star. It's as simple as that. I know that when the Cubs go into Milwaukee next year, I'll be very excited to watch those games. That's going to be interesting, because some of the comments out of Milwaukee made it clear that maybe he's not the local hero anymore. Awkward.
It is definitely awkward, especially the fact that he went to the division rival. But the flip side is, right, like you leading up to this decision, one of the big talking points when everyone thought it was going to be Milwaukee or New York was, oh, Craig Council, he's from, just north of Milwaukee. His dad used to work for the Brewers. He's going to want to stay close to home. And what no one considered was like, okay, there's another major league team in a quote-unquote big market that's pretty close to home. Like, if for those who are not well-versed in geography, Milwaukee and Chicago were like a two-hour drive apart. And so he basically is like, I don't want to say having his cake and eating it too, but maybe like he gets to stay pretty close to home. He gets the trappings of a big market. And to the extent that he can, remember, like, baseball season's pretty busy. He will be able to sort of see his, see his sons play college baseball and be close to his family. So, like, good for him.
Good for him. But you know what? He better win. He better win. At our final topic here, I think this was expected, but it's nice to see it confirmed. The Phillies have noted that Bryce Harper will remain a first baseman. Last year, coming back from his Tommy John, he was a DH at first. Couldn't really throw, so they put him at first base. And two things, right? First of all, credit to him. He did very well, like learning this midseason. It's not an easy position to learn out of nowhere, and he did pretty well by all indications, all metrics. And then there's this whole ripple effect where it made the Phillies defense so much better, because now he's playing first base and you can get Schwarber at DH, because Schwarber is one of the weakest outfielders in baseball. You got Rojas and Pache and March in the outfield. And like, it made such an improvement on the Phillies defense that it was difficult for me to see them ever going back. And not only that, Harper, as difficult as this is for me to believe, is going to turn 32 years old next year. That's not possible. It doesn't feel like it's okay. I think it's going to be a sixth season with the Phillies already. Like, I thought he just signed that deal. It felt like, you know, even from when he signed the deal, he was probably not going to be an outfielder forever. Moving to first base seemed like it would make sense at some point. I don't think everybody thought it would happen in exactly this way. So this makes sense. And then, the secondary aspect of this is Rhys Hoskins is not going to be back. I did read that Dave Dombrowski, when this decision was made, actually called Hoskins directly and said, listen, this is the deal. We love you. We respect you. But at this point, Harper's playing first base. We may not have room for you to come back. He's a free agent, which I respect that. I think that's a nice thing to do. But it does seem that's an unexpected way for Hoskins' Philadelphia career to most likely come to an end.
Yeah, I mean, his first year with the Phillies, he came up midseason 2017. He played 50 games. Hit 18 homers in 50 games and finished fourth in the Rookie of the Year voting. He was a great story. He's turned out to be more of like a good, not great player. But he will be an interesting player to kind of watch in the free agent market, because I think that like he's got power. He's like a known, kind of a known quantity. I think there will be and there's not a ton of power hitting on the market. So I think he will be in reasonable demand, especially now that all 30 teams have a DH spot to employ. I will say, and I think we're in disagreement on the Scott Boras pun game every year at the GM meetings and the winter meetings. When Scott Boras first started doing the pun thing, I couldn't stand it. But now that he's been doing it for a few years now and he's kind of in on the joke, I kind of like it. And I see Mike shaking his head at me. I thought his one yesterday with Reese's Pieces will fit any team's puzzle. I thought that was some of his better work.
His heart's not in it anymore. Man, I'm the exact opposite. When he first started doing it, I was like, oh, this is funny. This is clever. Does he have someone in his office writing these puns? Almost certainly, yes. And the last year or two, it's almost been like, well, checking the box, you know, got to make some puns. The Monty Hall one, like a totally up to date reference.
That was a disaster, because Monty Hall, he was like talking about Jordan Montgomery as like the merchandise, but Monty Hall is the host. That was a total mixed metaphor.
Pick a different door to get another pitcher? Like,
that one did not work at all. That was maybe the worst one ever.
Anyway, I disagree with you a little bit about Hoskins, just because there's a lot of right-handed DH types, right? JD Martinez is a free agent. Justin Turner is a free agent, much older than Hoskins, yes, but probably still better bat. So I think that market's going to get a little bit crowded. And what I'm trying to say is I'm very excited for Rhys Hoskins to hit 42 home runs for the Rockies next year and then get traded after that. Yes, Rockies talk. We'll be right back on the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Back on the MLB.com Ballpark Dimension podcast, Mike Petrillo and Matt Myers. One thing I like to do each year is to look at where every team's roster starts the offseason. And I think for a lot of people, that's just, well, what was the record last year? That's where they start the season now. And it's not true. Obviously, a lot of things happened over the course of last season, but also players are free agents now, you know? So you can look at the Cubs, for example, and look at what they did in 2023. But Cody Bellinger is no longer employed by the Cubs. Marcus Stroman is no longer employed by the Cubs. So you only can really look at what you have now and what holes you need to fill and not worry about the fact that, you know, the Padres had Josh Hader last year and Blake Snell. They don't know. So it doesn't matter. So the way I did this was I looked at our friends at Fangraphs, who helpfully have up-to-date depth charts, and using projections from Steamer, you can kind of look through and say, well, who's looking great and who's not? And I'm not going to read you all 30 because I wrote way too many words about it on the site that you can go look at. You'll be shocked to know the Braves are number one. The Rockies are last. Matt, there were a couple teams that stood out to me that I want to highlight to you. The first one that really stood out to me was that the Astros are rated number two. And I feel like this might be, I don't want to say the last hurrah, but I feel like they're going to be very good this year because they're not really losing free agents, you know, a couple of relievers, Martin Maldonado, but they have some real questions upcoming about Bregman and Altuve being free agents after this year, Kyle Tucker a year after that. So it's like 2024, even though they don't have a manager yet, is a huge deal. I was surprised at number two, though.
I was surprised by that as well. And I mean, for Altuve, it's also just like age, right? Like, how long can he keep doing this? Maybe he is just that good. It's also just so hard to project. You know, like, there are certain player archetypes that are a little easier to project than others. His is like, they're really like, he's a little bit of a one of a kind. So it's hard to know, like maybe he just is that much of an outlier. They have between him and Tucker and Alvarez, they have three like superstar hitters, which most teams don't have. And then Bregman's still a pretty good player. So I agree with you. It's going to be a good team. The two definitely surprised me. I mean, there was a few of them that surprised me. I want to hear another one that surprised you, and then I'll share a couple of mine.
The two that surprised me in terms of lofty ranks, aside from this, were probably the Yankees at seven. And, you know, we just talked about them, so I don't want to go too deeply into it. But basically, I think what's happening there is you got to expect that Aaron Judge won't have a freak injury again. You got to expect you'll have more from Rodon and more from Nestor Cortez, right? Like, better health, I think, is not unreasonable. Do I think they're the seventh best team right now? No. The other one that stats me is the Cardinals. My personal ranking would have the Cardinals at, like, I don't know, 22, and they're ranked 12th here, which is stunning to me because they have no starting rotation. They need at least three starters, probably some relievers. And what's basically happening here is they have the 22nd best pitching projected and the 9th best position player group, which I get it, because I think people overlooked the fact that Wilson Contreras is actually pretty good down the stretch last year. I'm confident that he's going to be good next year. You still got Goldschmidt and Arenado, which is Goldschmidt's 36. I don't really trust Dylan Carlson. I feel like I have more questions about the offense, and I have a billion more questions about the pitching.
Yeah, there was actually Garrett Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday did a piece, and he talked about how the Cardinals, because they're left-handed hitting bats, might be a good fit for the Yankees, who need some left-handed hitting bats. So I thought that was an interesting one. The Yankees were another team that jumped out to me, going back to our conversation at the beginning of the podcast with the way the sky is falling with amongst Yankees fans. It's like, oh, actually, they still have a pretty good roster. And I think that, you know, the injuries last year, Cortez is a perfect example. Like, honestly, I totally forgot that he missed that much time. And I mean, yes, on the one hand, the best predictor of injury is a future injury is past injury. So you don't want to like bet on too much health, especially with a guy like Rodon. That said, like, it's probably not going to be as bad as it was in 2023, and they still should be a pretty good team. But I think more than anything, it's just a really good exercise of just sort of like reminding yourself, okay, like who's actually on which team now? Because sometimes we lose sight of that, and it can get a little confusing too. Because sometimes guys re-sign with their team, and it almost throws off, like, oh, this guy was a free agent. Like, if you know, last year it was like the Yankees re-signed Judge, but like, no, he was a free agent. They did not have him on November 1st. You kind of have to account for that when you're thinking about how they have to build their roster that offseason.
Totally right. As far as a team or two at the other end, a team I was surprised was low. The Cubs actually come in at 19th. And at first that shocked me, right? I'm like, what? The Cubs, they're on the way up. And then I remembered, as we just kind of mentioned, they're an 83 win team. And right now they don't have Bellinger or Stroman or Candelario. Like, they have a ton of work to do. The other one that surprised me for being this low was the Reds are 22nd. And I guess I'm not sure if that surprises me as much as I think it should, because there's definitely like the vibes and the helium, right? I'm like, oh, the Reds, exciting, young on the way up. Then you realize their starting rotation was dreadful last year, right? A 5.43 ERA, that's the third highest. And then you look at their rotation for this upcoming season, like Hunter Green, Andrew Abbott, Graham Ashcraft, like those are three talented pitchers, right? They haven't entirely stayed healthy and productive. They're more, I think, promise than production at this point. And it's kind of the same thing for a lot of the young infielders. Like Ellie De La Cruz, we have said a million nice things about him. He was a below average hitter last year. You know, like, he needs to make a ton of steps forward. And then you've got all these other guys like Spencer Steer, like, you know, Nick Senzel, Matt McClain. They're all nice players. But now I look at the Reds like roster and like, who do I trust? I don't trust the rotation. I love all the young talent, but that needs to be turned into production. And I guess it's 22 too low. Sure. But where would I put them? I don't know. 18th? It's not that low.
The benefit that they have, right, is that their division is eminently winnable. And that's like, you know, going back to our Brewers discussion, that's the biggest reason for the Brewers not to blow it up. But like, speaking of the Reds, I think De La Cruz is a perfect example, right, where it's like, he looks like he's going to be a superstar and could be. He has the sort of the makings, the tools, but he's got to put it together, right? Then after that hot start, it was pretty underwhelming. And could I see him getting MVP votes next year? Yes. could I see him being optioned to AAA? Yes. Like, there's a lot. The error bar on Ellie De La Cruz's 2024 season is incredibly wide. And that's like, it's hard to, projections are going to always be a little bit conservative. But like, if he and McClain pop, you could have two like superstars in the middle of the infield or on the left side of the infield. And you're like, oh, wow, this is like a great young superstar duo. But it could also be a lot less than that. So I think, you know, you always want to, especially with a player like De La Cruz, who kind of like, you know, stretches the imagination. You really want, you want to hope for the best as a baseball fan. But like, there is some real downside there.
Yeah, I guarantee you what's going to happen is the Reds are a good example, right? But this could apply to any team. Maybe they'll go out and they'll go nuts and they'll trade for Dylan Cease and Corbin Burns, right? And then they'll win 90 games next year. And people will find this and come back and say, oh, you have them rated 22nd. I'm like, that's the whole point. Right now, they don't have those pitchers. Like, that's literally the point of the exercise. I'm going to ask you a question I don't think you'll know the answer to. Of the 30 fan bases, which one was the most annoyed at me for this? It will shock and surprise you. I'll tell you this. Not a contending team. Not a team that was actually very good last year. Who did I hear the most from?
Hold on, I'm going to eyeball this very quickly. I'm going to say it is the Royals.
No, actually not. The 28th ranked Washington Nationals. People were upset about that. That's because two things. I think one is that they're rated here below the A's, and obviously there's not a lot of good feelings about the A's. Although I'll point out the A's, Mason Miller, Zach Gelof, Ryan Nota, Brent Rooker, like they had some nice stories and they were much better in the second half than the disastrous first half. The thing about the Nationals is we did not expect them to be very good. I think I projected them as the exact same win-loss record as the A's heading into last year. And then the difference ended up being like 17 wins or whatever, right? But the Nationals just aren't projected that great for next year because they need these young guys to improve, right? They need time. That was my biggest need for them is they need time. They need improvement. They need, you know, CJ Abrams, Keiber Ruiz, Mackenzie Gore to get better. They need Dylan Cruz and James Wood to show up. Nobody suggested like, oh, they're great. They're going to make the playoffs this year. No, people just didn't like them being behind the A's, which I guess I understand when you look at the difference in win-loss record. That's a tough one. I tell you this, nobody complained the Rockies were in last place. And I think there's going to be an interesting conversation about whether the Rockies have enough pitching to get through the year because Sensatella's hurt, Marquez is hurt. That's going to be a thing. Nobody complained about that one, I'm sorry to say. Was there anybody else you wanted to point out?
I think we covered the big ones.
Okay, that's going to do it for our show this week. Thank you for listening to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Don't miss an episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. See you next week.